We are going to convene momentarily a subcommittee of the Subcommittee on General Government for the purpose of taking testimony on Senate Bill 5528, the Board of Tax Practitioners. So I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 5528 and ask the agency and the others to come forward and begin their presentation. Just to remind everybody, while you're coming forward, we operate in an acronym-free zone. And as you begin your testimony, if you would say your name for the record and spell your last name, it would be helpful to our staff.
S-A-Z-F,
acronym-free zone. Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah, we can say
an AZF. That's where we are.
It's the only one we can use.
He asked if he could bring water. I said yes, but if he had anything to mix with it, he had to share.
That's noted for the record.
Yeah, sure. But we weren't on the record just yet. Good morning. My name is Ron Burson. Last name is spelled B as in boy, E-R-S-I-N. I'm the executive director for the Board of Tax Practitioners. Donna,
I am Donna Gilmore, G-I-L-M-O-U-R. And I am the chair of the board.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyay from the Department of Administrative Services, U-P-A-D-H-Y-A-Y.
Good morning. Please begin.
Okay. I'd like to start off with the mission of the Board of Tax Practitioners. The Board of Tax Practitioners works to protect consumers by ensuring that Oregon tax professionals are competent and ethical in their professional activities. Consumer protection is the focus of the Board of Tax Practitioners, as shown in the agency's mission. The mission describes the Board's desire to protect consumers through their programs of ensuring competent and ethical professionals, tax professionals, excuse me. These programs include the agency's licensing program.
Ron, can I stop you?
Sure.
Could you just talk with us? We're not frightening guys, and I just don't want you to read this whole thing. We'll all drop dead if that happens.
Okay. And I'm sorry.
You have a good story to tell. Just tell us.
Okay. I was going to actually turn it over now for some historical data, but I wanted to talk about that this was a board that was established in 1973. And the reason it was established is because Oregonians came to the legislature and said, we fear the information that we give to tax practitioners can harm us if they do wrong with it. And so they asked the legislature to establish a regulation on people that prepare personal income taxes in the state. That is our focus, personal income taxes. So we don't do the corporate taxes and the other kind of taxes that the state has. This board was asked to be established to establish a minimum level of competency to work in the tax field. And so that was kind of how it started, and again, started back in 1973. I was going to turn over some historical data to our chair, Donna Gilmore. She's been fortunate enough to be involved in the industry since its inception.
We would welcome her testimony. Good morning.
I can talk all morning. We have 31 years of background. I want to say that the agency is today as it was formed 31 years ago, with that focus in mind. We have two tiers of licensing. We license tax preparers as an in-road to the profession. And after several years of working underneath management, they can take another test. They have already taken one. They can take a harder test and become a consultant, at which time they can go into business for themselves or work with others. At this point, we have about 4,000 licensees in the state of Oregon, which has been a pretty constant number. One of our performance measures is to increase that number. We would like to see more people in the profession. It is a profession made by this agency. To me.
Prior to the inception of the agency, I would say that an income tax preparer was a work person. And after this agency became established, the income tax preparer practitioner became a profession. And it has become a profession nationwide. And I had a few comments I was going to make this morning that I haven't even shared with Ron. I don't know that he's ever heard this. But at least 20 years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., in the office of the director of practice, as it was called at that time, of the Internal Revenue Service. And he said to me, he said, Donna, nationwide, we will never have what Oregon has. She looked up at that. And that's a statement I have never forgotten, because we are the ones that initiated it. We are still the only state in the union that has a program like this. It's important. And last year, the Taxpayer Advocacy Committee of the Internal Revenue Service took to the Congress a requirement, a change that's necessary nationwide for income tax practitioners. And they said to the Congress, we need a program similar to Oregon. So it's kind of like the bottle bill, and we're very proud of it.
Mrs. Gilmore, could I interrupt you and ask a question that stems from my service on this committee in prior legislative sessions? And that is, given your obvious pride in the standard of professionalism for your industry in Oregon, what do you do about border communities? And I know Senator or Representative Butler spent a lot of time worrying about Ontario that's so close to Idaho. My whole district borders on the state of Washington, and there are lots of connect points across. How, if someone lives in Rainier and they perhaps go across the river to Longview, what does your industry do to try to protect those Oregon consumers who live in border towns and maybe find their way across the river into a different state that may not have the same high ethical and professional standards?
Senator Johnson, there's two answers, because our compliance officer, of course, is watching those people. We have a case right now before the board where the person would come over and interview a taxpayer in a restaurant in Portland, and then he would go to Vancouver and do the tax return. He called and checked into licensing, decided he didn't want to spend that extra dollar to be licensed. He didn't want to do the continuing education, so he continued that practice. And he is now being fined because he did do tax returns. He did interview clients here in Oregon. And so we have the compliance area. Educationally, our associations work with other states. And in Ontario, where Senator Butler is, the state of Idaho comes over, and many are members and some are officers in the Oregon Association of Tax Consultants. They get their education. They are licensed by the state of Oregon, even though their offices are in Boise or Puyallup, wherever they may be. And so educationally-wise and association-wise, we cover a lot of those people. And we, years ago, went into those states and tried to invigorate their interest in a similar program such as we have. But we've never been able to get those states to go.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
It does. Senator Morissette.
What authority do you have to fine someone who lives in another state for not complying with the Oregon law?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette. The authority that we have is if somebody comes across the border into our state to prepare a personal income tax return, then they need to be licensed in this state. And if they are not licensed in this state, then they can't advertise here, and we will we have the ability to put a notice out.
I'm sorry.
Senator Morissette, follow.
I guess I asked the question the wrong way. What authority do you have to collect the fine that you levied on that person in another state? I mean, you know, they don't. Can you go over there and force them to pay the fine?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette. This agency actually doesn't do its own collections. We use the Department of Revenue and a collection agency, and the collection agency does have the ability to go outside of the state to collect any of our civil penalties that are out there. I'd like to go back to your question, Senator Johnson. A couple of other things that we do is we encourage the people on those border towns to license with us, because they want to take advantage. Example is Vancouver. Many of the people working in Vancouver do want to work in Portland because there is a chance, you know, a larger customer base there. And we have many people that are licensed with us that live on, in those border towns. So we encourage that. The other thing is we, on the other side, we inform Oregonians of the advantages of the licensure law here in town. And would encourage them to at least look at a task prepare here in this state before they venture over the river and look at one in another state. So those are a couple of things.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt the flow of your presentation, but I was just curious about that and your obvious pride of the program here. It just caused me to ask the question. So continue, please.
Where was I? Somebody else asked me a question. Where do you want me to go?
Well, you had been focusing on the mission of the agency and talking a little bit about the genesis of your board and your licensing procedures. And
thank you, Senator Johnson, for getting me started again. We're a small agency, of course. We have staff of four. We have seven board members, six of which are licensed tax consultants. And I don't know if I went over that too quickly, but our beginning level is licensed tax preparers and then licensed tax consultants. So our board is made up of the higher tenor and one public member. One of our main focuses, of course, is our education. You take, in order to get into the program, you go to either a college, a community college, one of the tax companies that has a tax school. We have an 80-hour required beginning educational process. And then after that is successfully completed, we have a beginning then examination. If you pass that examination, then you can become licensed. And then at the second tier, we have a second harder examination, which if you pass that, then you become a licensed tax consultant. We have 30 hours of continuing education required every year. And those are the things that our staff does. They keep track of those. So they keep track of our licensees, of the education that they have taken. We have one staff member who is in charge of education and examination, and she is in touch with all the colleges, the state, all the tax schools, all of the organizations that prepare correspondence courses, which will qualify for the education requirement. We have a compliance officer whose duty, of course, then to answer these questions. He takes the phone calls. He keeps a compliance log, and one of our performance measures currently is to keep those answers within a 12-hour period that compliance officer is on to that complaint to follow up and either mediate it or look into it or further whatever falls into his jurisdiction. And then, of course, our fourth staff person is our director that oversees the entire program. I have a success story that I want to tell before I turn it over to him, because he won't tell you this success story. But I want to congratulate the board that we had about 4 years ago, because we were in trouble financially, and that's why we're here today. In March of 2002, our bank balance was in minus position. We were in the wrong area. And we had to borrow $90,000 from the emergency board to get current. And the board at that time spent hours. I was sitting in the public sector at that time listening to hours of committee work, trying to determine where the money was going, we'd never had a problem before. That was March and summer of 2002. In September, we found ourselves with 2 weeks' notice to find a new director. So we moved our compliance officer up to an interim directorship, and for a year, we managed with a staff of three, our interim director subbed as the compliance officer as well. He did double duty. The first thing he did after coming on in the fall of 2002 was pay the bills. The second thing he did was prepare a budget for this committee. But after he got that done, then he was able to start making cuts. And he took a pencil and he sharpened it and he made cuts like a business person would. He cut printing. He cut little things. We used to have 6 meetings a year. Now we have 5. We used to go out into the state 2x a year. Now we go once. But you can see that these things, in the printing and postage area, it was a large dollar that was saved. So that by 2003, when we hired him on then, a year later, as our full director, March, which is our low month, had a balance of $12,000. So he brought it from a minus 90 up to 12. In March of 2005, we have a bank balance of $126,000, and we're looking at an ending balance at the end of the biennium of $216,000, which will give us 3 to 4 months of ending balance on hand.
And all that was done with efficiencies and economies and not raising fees? Or
exactly. And I have to tell this story because he won't. So I hope I don't embarrass him too much. But the board can work with this person, and the staff works well, and we are happy. We're a happy group.
Well, with that kind of a tee-up, would you please continue your voice?
I think he's really a son.
Pardon me?
I think she's really his mom.
Yeah, Senator Parsons, we ought to just gamble out and call it a day.
I think we have some things we're going to talk about further. But going back to summarizing the programs, we have a licensing program. Folks come in and they want to obtain a license in the state. Again, there's 2 levels of licensure, the apprentice level to prepare, the journeyman level for a better, lack of a better word, as a consultant. Donna Gilmore had alluded to the fact that we are trying to increase the number of consultants in the state. And it isn't because we want more fees. It's because the people of the state are asking for that. At this time, the state population is increasing faster than we can replace the folks. And when we get a little further into this presentation, there's a performance measure around the number of returns prepared by each person. We feel there's a danger if the number of returns increases significantly to the number of preparers out there, there's a danger of increasing errors because they're just getting too darn busy. They're getting too many people in there. So we have some programs in place trying to respond to this. But licensing is one program that we have. Another program that we do, it's examinations and education. And we actually administer 2 examinations, one for preparer and one for a consultant. We also maintain those examinations. In other words, we update those each year to bring in the new tax law. You know, the laws are changing all the time.
Are those exams given with pencil and paper or electronically?
They're actually given with pencil and paper. And the way that we deliver that product is in the past, Donna talked a little bit about historical perspective. In the past, the board itself held the examinations, usually here in the valley. And we rented a space. We had people come in and take them. Well, folks from the corners of the state were having to travel quite a ways to take those examinations at an expense of their own. And also those tests were at our convenience, not their convenience. So we devised a program with the community colleges throughout the state that they would proctor our examinations for a very reasonable fee of not more than $30. That's the highest fee that's out there. We have a contractual agreement with them. So now if somebody from Ontario wants to take an examination, they don't have to travel 8 hours to do that and stay in a hotel. Now they can take it at Treasure Valley Community College at their convenience. So that's how we do the examinations. We have looked at touchscreen testing, and that may be a future item, but at this point it is not. Now, on the examinations, when I say we maintain those for a very reasonable price throughout each year. And when I say reasonable price, I'm looking at about $1,200 per year to actually update those tests. And a big reason we can do that is because our board members volunteer their time to come in and have a work session on the questions. We actually look at the questions for any updates that need to happen and change those questions. The public member that we had, we have right now, but unfortunately we're losing her as of May. She's retiring from Chemehuevin Community College and moving out of state. But she was actually one of these psychometricians, these folks that are wordsmithers. And she came in and did a lot of work on our tests to try to make sure that we're asking the questions correctly, so there's not a lot of ambiguous language in there. And, of course, by having her on the board, her time was volunteered to us, so we appreciated that.
The chair needs you to repeat that word.
Psychometrician.
Psychometrician.
Could you define that, please, Madam Chair?
I don't have a clue. I'm from Scappoose. We don't use words
Perhaps
like that.
Representative Krupp would like to define it for us.
Not a good idea, Representative.
I may not have the Webster's Dictionary of the definition of committee members, but I can tell you what she did was a valuable asset to our board. I know our tests have improved from that. But we give these tests throughout the year. The main focus of the testing time is in December, early January. And that is because the schools we talked about, which are private schools out there that teach the basic course, they graduate their folks in the first or second week of December. And so the board does hold one examination now. It's been held at Chemeketa Community College. And the reason that we do that is because it we're able to test up to 250 to 300 people at one time, and it coincides with the people graduating from this class. So it's right after they get through with their class, they can jump right into a test, and then they also do not have to pay a proctor fee. We don't charge a proctor fee.
Out of your universe of 200 people that would sit the examination, how many would be expected to pass? I'm trying to get a sense of how rigorous the testing is.
We look at that each year, and actually this year our percentage went down a little bit, and we're looking at reasons why that happened. But for PREPARE, we're looking at a percentage of right around anywhere between 60 to 65% of the people passing that exam. For the consultants, it's lower. It is about 40% of the people passing the examination on their first try.
Thank you.
Now, these examinations are very reasonably priced. We priced the PREPARE's examination at $40. The consultant's examination is at $70. So it is the people that are taking these tests, especially the PREPARE's, can't afford a lot of money to take the test, so we've tried to keep the prices very reasonable so they can get in there. The next program we have is the compliance program, and Mrs. Gilmore talked about that. We receive approximately about 100 complaints each year. It varies. One thing about compliance work is the more you're out there, the more you're going to stir it up. So the more work you do, the more work you get. And that's fine. That's what it should be. I mean, one of this is we're going to protect Oregonians. We should be telling Oregonians what we're doing out there to protect them so they use our services. And so I like seeing an increase, and actually for this year so far we've done right at 75 complaints, and you know, season's just kind of starting now, so I predict that this year we'll actually be above 100 complaints for this biennium.
Define complaints.
A complaint is we look at when somebody calls in here and they have a problem with the person that's preparing their tax return. It can come from a consumer. It can come from another licensee. It can come from another state agency. We work very closely with the Department of Revenue. If they see somebody that is coming up on audit quite a bit that's a paid preparer, they inform us of that, and we get involved to try to stop that behavior from happening. So we're defining anybody that comes in and has a complaint against somebody else. Now, a lot of these complaints are customer service complaints, or that we try to get the people back together. We mediate these. Obviously, an agency our size, we cannot prosecute everybody that's out there. So we have to look at ways to make sure that the customer is protected, the consumer is protected, and that we get those people back together so they get the best product possible from their paid professional.
You get involved with fee disputes?
We do not regulate the fees other than you have to post your fees if you're given a discount. So if you're going to tell somebody you're giving 25% off, you better have those fees posted. In other words, don't just add 25%. We let the industry dictate, or the industry dictate what they can charge for a fee. Now, if somebody calls up and says, I paid X number of dollars for this and I didn't get anything, we're going to get involved in that. Or I can't get my records back or something like this. The big part of our compliance work, and probably some of the most important part of our compliance work, is around unlicensed people in the state. The fly-by-night folks that come in here because there's a chance to make money in a short amount of time. And sometimes we kind of discount that idea, but I want to give the committee a couple examples that happened this last year. We had a person set up a shop in a Sukasa store in Hillsboro. Sukasa is a market for the Hispanic community. And And we heard about it. We got up there the next day. She had been operating for a month and a half and had done 650 returns in that month and a half at an average of about $150 return. That person made $90,000 plus in
a month and a half.
In a month and a half.
Thinking about a career change?
Yeah. I'm out of here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Avakian.
Did you say Su Casa?
Su Casa.
So was this mostly a Latino population they were serving?
That is exactly correct. And in fact, while we were trying to sort this out, people were either coming in at the time to drop off information or coming back to pick up completed returns from us. This is a very large investigation that happened, and actually the Department of Justice Criminal Division has since taken it over and has prosecuted her.
Good.
Because it was a lot of identity theft that went along with the same thing. So unless we're quick to react to these folks, first of all, they're going to be out of the state. And second of all, we're not going to protect these folks. And really the sad thing about this was 650 people came to somebody that wanted to file a correct return. They didn't want to cheat the government. They actually wanted to file a correct return. They came in there, and this person took their money, did not do the correct work for them, and they lost out.
Did you have any chance to follow up on that, both from a consumer protection perspective and from just a goodwill perspective? What I'm thinking is an article for the Hispanic Chamber News or something that might serve as a warning to others to not fall prey to these kind of scam artists.
Yes, Chair Johnson, we have become quite involved with the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. In fact, on the 22nd of this month, we will be speaking at a luncheon up there talking about just these issues. If folks are coming to you, get a hold of us right away, and we will stop this behavior immediately for you. So, yes, at one time this board had talked about hiring a person that actually spoke Spanish, and maybe that would do it. But we've actually found better ways of doing that by partnering with other agencies and partnering with local governments and local agencies and Hispanic groups. And it's not just the Hispanic groups. There's a Russian community. There's other communities out there, too, to try to stop these behaviors and get people talking with government agencies. And it's been great with the Hispanic community because they typically have not wanted to come to government or look to government for help. And now we're starting to turn that around. They're actually inviting us up to luncheons to talk to them about these issues.
May I?
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. That's interesting because in Lane County in Eugene, there was a very large Hispanic store that had their grand opening last week or 2 weeks ago and so on. So do you have statewide contacts with the Hispanic Chambers of Commerce?
At this time, I'm sorry, Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, at this time, we have concentrated in the Valley. So it's in the Portland metropolitan area is a kind of our first step into getting there. We haven't got into the Eugene area.
I may follow.
But that's a great suggestion.
Well, I may also. But please do contact them statewide if possible.
So part of this program is stopping unlicensed activity in the state. The harm to the consumer can be great, and it can be in a short amount of time. And so that is a very focal point. I mean, we talk about performance measures. Our measure is an initial response time to a complaint. So we feel it's important that a person calls in, that they get a response back very quickly, and that response time is under 12 hours. And actually, since July of this last year, we've been averaging about 2 hours back to folks. And that includes counting. If somebody calls us at 5 o'clock and we don't get back to them at 9 o'clock the next day, that we count the overnight hours. So it's real time that we're looking at.
One other thing about this is that you are doing, I think, a great service, a great public service, and you might look for other publications that invite articles. I'm thinking about the publication that the League of Oregon Cities does, the publication that the Association of Oregon Counties does. They have very fine newsletters that go out, and this might give you an opportunity to both tell a success story and partner with local government in giving a warning and a heads up to these fraudulent preparers and scam artists. And you shouldn't be a bit shy about telling a story of great public service.
I appreciate that suggestion.
Let me interrupt and say that we did have a press release, Senator Johnson, that went out just last week. to McMinnville area.
Yes.
And one last month that went to, I've read two. Where was the other one? To the small communities, advising them of the problems and to be certain that you go to a licensed tax preparer.
This might also be the kind of story that the news stations would pick up on, the television.
We'll do that, right?
Well, actually...
we have a distinguished member of the media here with us.
I can, as long as the chair doesn't mind. Actually, the last couple of weeks on the air on my Sunday show, I've been talking about successful things that government has been doing. And I would love to share this story, as long as the chair would give me permission to do so, and I won't if you won't.
Well, actually, I would recommend it, and perhaps you guys could get together. I know you know Representative Krupp hosts a radio show, and you might get together and talk about how you could frame this both as a public service program, and also people are so quick to jump on the things government does wrong. Here's an opportunity to tell, I think, a pretty remarkable success story.
It is.
And I would welcome that opportunity.
And I might interrupt and say that one of the other stations has a panel about the first week of April. I've been on that panel for many years, and we take questions over the air, over the telephone, and answer tax questions.
Oh.
Are you familiar with that program?
I am not.
The Oregon Association of Tax Consultants works with Channel 2.
Well, actually, Channel 2 is our news partner, so that works well.
We do that every year.
I did not know that.
As a service.
Well, I think if no member of the panel objects, that we would welcome this as a public service opportunity and urge you to go ahead. So
I will contact you.
We'll chat after.
Senator Morsett.
Lane Community College, KLCC, has a Sunday program, and I'd like to talk with you about that also, too. But I need a copy of your press release, so we need a copy of your press release as a reference. But
we may have to examine your budget for a media person after your presentation.
the one thing I will mention about the press release that we put out in the McMinnville area is we had an unlicensed person in there that we actually have a notice out on for 1,300-plus violations of preparing without a license. And, of course, that affects a lot of people in that community. And he had actually had a hearing, and he the day before the hearing, he says, you know, I think I need to have a lawyer. And so he asked for a continuance the day before the hearing, and we granted that continuance because we felt as though the administrative law judge was going to grant it anyway. But we asked him to sign a stipulated order that he would not prepare returns during this season because we feared that this was just a way to him to get another year in. And this is $100,000+ in this 3-month time that he's been making, according to his records that he's provided our office. And that all sounded fine, but when I sent our compliance person out to his office to check to see if it was or was not working, he was working, and he actually informed us that he was not going to quit working. So the reason we put a press release out was we can't stop him legally. The legal process just isn't fast enough to stop the behavior. So we tried to go around the other side and stop the customers from coming to him. So we're going to inform the customers that he is not qualified to prepare the return. So that's why that press release went out.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does the public know who has been certified, who has not? Is there any way that they practically can know?
Senator Johnson, Senator Morris, we do several things. First of all, on the businesses that we register, we have them list the licensed tax consultants in there. And so we list it as a license, similar to what you see construction contractors do where they list the license number on there. We also put out information to folks that if somebody's not signing a return and putting their license number on there, you shouldn't pay for it. Plain and simple. I mean, if they're going to charge you, they should be signing that. Other things that we do is, of course, we field any kind of calls that come in. We put out information to folks to call us if they have questions about their tax repair, to use our service so we tell people whether they're licensed. And there's also on our website, there are firms listed on there that are advertising with us that have been checked by us.
Follow-up.
Let me question the Dallas here. When the Department of Revenue sends mailings, all households get a mailing. Is it possible, or would it be helpful if in that mailing they had a list of the licensed tax practitioners and a strong advisory that, you know, if you have your return prepared by another party, that they need to be certified just as an additional piece of public service, if they had that kind of communication?
Chair, Senator Morse, we'd have to look into that with the department, because that could be perceived as like advertising for them. But
Brian, do you have a comment?
I do have a comment. The Department of Revenue does put a statement in their instructions around the licensing laws, and that if you are paying somebody to prepare your returns, then they need to be licensed in the state and they can contact us. So there is a statement in there. There just isn't all the 4,000 individuals are not listed there. And frankly, I think it would be difficult to keep that list up for the department each year. So, but they do work with us because they recognize the importance of our licensing laws.
Senator Morset.
Thank you. I can't believe that you can't stop this person. It's a fraudulent activity. The AG's office is there to do immediate action and injunction from a judge to cease and desist. I mean, there have got to be ways of doing that.
And I'm sorry. Chair Johnson, Senator Morrison, there are ways of doing it. I maybe I misspoke. Uh-huh. You can do it. The problem is the time frame to do that. It takes time for you to get into court and to get these things done. And he is represented at this time, too. So his attorney is actually delaying some of the And my fear was is the delays were going to get past April 15th, which is when the majority of the damage is done.
One
follow-up, Senator Marshall.
You're working with the AG's office, right?
Correct.
Good. Okay, thank you.
The last program I'll go into is administration, and that is the board themselves. Our chair had alluded to there are seven members. Six of them are licensed tax consultants. One is a public member, and myself. This program is responsible for managing the board's resources, including the personnel. It's responsible for creating a budget. It's responsible for the day-to-day operations of the board. The executive director's performance is reviewed by the board annually, and the executive director is hired by the board. The board members themselves are appointed by the governor's office for three-year terms, and they can serve up to three terms. We'll go on with the this was listed out in our organizational chart, and I've also listed what those positions, their position titles, and their classifications are. The agency pays the board a $30 stipend for each day that they come in, and then any approved expenses they have while here, the overnight stays and meal, the per diem meals. The board has worked with us very closely on containing those costs, trying to keep those costs down. So I think we've had simple meals while we've been working, whereas before we maybe had some higher-end catered meals that had come in. So they've worked with us very close, and frankly, I think everybody's happy with that type of thing. The one thing that the agency is continuing to do is we're continuing to look at ways to better deliver our product, to give better service. And I give some examples. In the past, and I've talked to you folks about this, in the past, people would call up and ask for copies of things, and we would mail that out to them. Well, that is on our website. And by the way, I think the question was asked or has been asked in the past on our website, and we have migrated over to Brand Oregon. So our website is on Brand Oregon, so we look like every other agency out there. But this was a good thing for this agency because beforehand we were using a free website with the state library, which is good, but it was very limited in size. So every time we had something new to go on, we pretty much had to take something off. But now with Brand Oregon, we actually have a larger capacity, and so we can. We're looking forward to doing a lot more with this website, delivering a lot more services to folks, and delivering it much quicker. An example of that is that in the past we have had newsletters that go out, and those newsletters are the printed type that not only take some time to put together, but there's printing costs and there's mailing costs to the licensees. And they come out twice a year. They come out on June 30th and October 31st. We are looking towards using this website to have an electronic newsletter. And an example of that is right now, if some news comes out that I got to get to my licensees, my newsletter doesn't come out till June. So what I have to do is I have to start using the association's newsletters. I put articles out there. But now I'm going to have a bulletin area on the website where people can go look and get up-to-date information right now. And, of course, that's at no cost to us other than getting it on there, which is just time, which we're paying for anything. So these are the type of things. We're always looking for better ways to deliver the product at a lower cost. And I think that's why this agency has gone from struggling with funds to having an imbalance that's reasonable at this time. I'll go forward with performance measures. I talked a little bit about performance measure number one. It is an issue with us in that the population of the state of Oregon is increasing faster than we can keep up. And we recognize this. Unfortunately, you can't just make tax professionals overnight. It takes programs. And one of the programs that we have out there is a mentorship program. We are asking licensed tax consultants to take their best and brightest that are preparers, that are working for them, and help them graduate to that next level. And then once they graduate to that next level, still be in their lives, help them with setting up a business, help them with obtaining clients so that they're successful even after they pass the exam, so that they stay in the profession. Our licensee base is aging. And right now we're replacing just about as many people that are retiring. We've come down just a little bit in 2003. I haven't got our 2004 numbers yet, but it's starting to pay off a little bit at this time, some of these programs. But again, it takes a couple of years to make a licensed tax consultant. I'm going to go back here.
I think we're up to speed with you, Ron, if you just want to keep going through the
There was one other program I wanted to talk about. I just had to remind myself in my notes. I apologize. But we are currently working with some of the professional chains out there, H&R Block, Jackson Hewitt's. They had a problem this last year of trying to open more offices. So, because they see the increased demand too, and they needed more preparers, the apprentice level preparers in there. And so we're working with them on ways to increase the number of people that are successful in passing the exam so that they have more people to hire. So we're also not just working with the individuals, but we're working with the corporations that are out there that are part of our licensee base.
Beyond the corporations, how about contact with any of the community colleges? Because this seems to me to be a professional opportunity with growth possibilities and something that could attract new bright people eager to enter the workforce. What kind of interaction have you had with the community colleges and make sure that the offerings in their curricula are complementary to developing tax practitioners?
There are several, Chair Johnson, there are several community colleges that offer this basic course that is out there, but we work with the community college very closely because they proctor our examinations, and they see the number of people that are coming in wanting to be part of the profession, and so they've also wanted to become part of creating more of those folks.
So, but Chemeketa is sort of your flagship community college. That is that a fair characterization?
I don't know if it's. I would call it a flagship. I might disagree on that term. PCC and Clackamas Community College are probably our two biggest users of our program at this point. But yes, we work closely with Chemeketa. They're easy to work with. They're close here in town. But we don't disregard Southern Oregon Community College, Southern Oregon University, some of the outlining areas, too.
Mrs. Gilmore?
Madam Chair, can I ask a follow-up?
Please, Representative Ivakian, then we'll come back to you, Mrs. Gilmore.
This is a really fascinating conversation because most of the boards and commissions seem to serve two primary functions. One is to do continuing education and licensing to, I guess, once people get into the profession, to make sure they remain competent. And the other is consumer protection. But you're talking about things that almost sound like recruitment to the profession or development at the educational level before they become professionals. And I'm just wondering if you have a broader mission, if you've developed a broader mission than most boards and commissions have. Am I hearing you right about that?
Senator Johnson, Senator Bakian, yes, we recognize the fact that we have to be looking 2 years ahead to be able to react to the needs of Oregonians. And where we're going to get these people that come into this industry is probably from some of these educational institutions around the state. And so we try to recruit people for that. We try to work with the corporations, and not just the big corporations either, but the smaller folks out there also, so that we can provide enough licensed individuals that they can continue to grow in their businesses out there. So I don't know if I answered your question.
It almost sounds like a closer link to OECDD than it does the Board of Accounts.
Mrs. Gilmore, you had a comment?
Senator Johnson, I think if you'll all of you go back in your memory, you'll remember that the community colleges have a financial problem. And many years ago, when I was teaching basic income tax at Clackamas Community College, we were the forerunner in the state. And because of the cuts at the community college level, our program, our basic classes that were being taught by professional tax people, had to go back into the college curriculum so that our income tax classes are now being taught by the accountancy part of the community college curriculum. We have been removed, so to speak, practically, from the teaching profession because of finances. And so this has created a problem for us over, I would say, 10 years or better.
That's a shame because it seems to me that you have the kind of entrepreneurial attitude towards recruitment of professionals into your industry. You're talking about competent people being able to earn a very satisfactory living, doing this kind of important work, a growth industry as people come into the state. And I think that's a shame that this kind of professional development opportunity isn't more readily available at the community college level.
We are working with them to point that out.
Good.
You know, it's a supply.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many of your licensees are also licensed by the Board of Accountancy?
Senator Johnson, Senator Morris, not an awful lot of them. There are a few people that hold both a certified public accountant and a licensed tax consultant at the same time. In the past, the Board of Accountancy, my understanding was, had some pretty tight rules on what you could call your business out there if you were a CPA, and our rules were a little more lax, and some folks came over and got a licensed tax consultant, a license from us so that they could call their business something. not a lot.
And
just a few.
By means of a not a lot, is that two? Is that a thousand?
I would say less than 100.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I could try to get that information for you for phase two. I could bring that in, but I'm guessing on the number. I know it's very few.
Small.
Okay, going on with our performance measures, this agency looks at the average number of continuing education hours received each year. We talked about continuing education, and that is another focal point of us. We require people to do 30 hours each year, and what we look at is, you know, 30 hours is the given. We actually encourage people to do more than that. And what we're doing is we're actually taking an average number of hours per year and encouraging people to report all the continuing education that they do, and just see how many people do voluntarily. If you require 30, well, they do more than that. We feel that there's a direct correlation between the education that people get and the knowledge they have in taxes. Now, it would be tough to say the quality of the education they get to the better tax returns, but unfortunately, that would be kind of hard to measure, but so we're looking at number of hours. And actually, in 2004, we hit right at 38 hours of continuing education per year. So we're one behind, but we're moving up the scale. People are getting the idea to go out there and get some education. So,
Representative Krupp, and then come back to Dallas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me for being gone. I just wanted to make a quick suggestion to you, if it hasn't been made already. In terms of your graphing, morph the two together so it's easier for us to read in terms of looking at your charting, and just for the future, it really is much simpler that way, and I don't have to work as hard. And that's good for me.
Okay, I apologize.
Mr. Winant.
Just a question, Madam Chair. If the requirement is 30 hours and everyone seems to be doing more, there must be a need for more than 30. So why don't you raise your requirement? Or has the board thought about that?
I'm sorry, Senator Johnson, Mr. Wyand. I don't think the board's actually come to the determination that there's a need for more than 30 hours. I think that we encourage it throughout the industry, but there's been a reluctance in the industry to actually require it. Sometimes we can get into these regulatory boards and we can kind of over-regulate folks. And so my feeling on it is if you continue to raise up the continuing hours of education, we go back to quality. You know, maybe I'm going to take easier courses so I get more hours than, you see what I'm saying, than to take maybe some of the harder courses that are more work. The board works very closely with a lot of private industry on continuing ed. Part of the reason this is raising up, too, is we have a lot more availability of continuing education. Our website lists all the continuation that is approved by the board from such companies as CCH.
Commerce Clearinghouse.
I didn't know
no
that.
No acronyms.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that. Surgeons, things like this. We list everything there, so if you can't get out to take a seminar, you can order a correspondence course. The board themselves, they actually review every one of those courses and approve them at board meetings. So they know that the board has approved those to meet our rules for continuing education. But I don't think the board's ever come back to say that they need to have more. We just encourage more.
Mrs. Gilmore.
Senator Johnson, we did move the continuing education from 20 to 30 hours, but I don't know how many years ago that was. Was it even 10 years ago? I mean, time passes so quickly. But at one time, when the original laws were put together, it was 20 hours, and we did move them up to 30.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What happens if a licensee doesn't get 30 hours per year?
Senator Johnson, Senator Morris, I'm glad you asked that question because unlike some previous testimony that I heard, this board actually looks at every applicant that comes in. They have to submit their continuing ed. If they don't have 30 hours, we don't license them for the next year. We don't audit a certain percentage. We actually look at every one of the applicants that come in. So we send them out a letter saying that you are short, or maybe they supplied 30 hours, but one of the classes was how to ride a bicycle. we didn't accept it. We would actually write them a letter and say, we've only accepted 26 hours. You need to provide us with 4 hours. We give them 60 days to provide that 4 hours of continuing education, and then we'll license them at that time. So if they don't have it, they don't receive a license for the next year.
Please.
And how many instances might there be, Ron, failure to meet that standard and pulling their ticket?
Well, I'm gonna break for just a second and turn around and ask my licensing specialist that.
Please.
If he doesn't mind. I can get you the exact numbers, but at this point, the best educated guess we have is about 200 preparers each year and about 75 consultants during their renewal.
One more follow-up.
Well, and what happens to these people that are deficient? How does the public know that they no longer have a license?
Senator Johnson, Senator Morse, one of the things that we do with our licenses each year is, it sounds like a simple thing, but we actually change the color of them. We inform the public that this year's color is green. People are required to post those licenses at their places of work, so where they're working. So if they don't, we wouldn't send them the new license if they don't have the continuing ed. And we also work with the businesses to make sure that the people that are working for them have their current license. So if you've hired the same preparer maybe the last 10 years, make sure you check this year that they have the green license, that they've actually updated their license. So we work with the businesses, and we encourage the people to look at that.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. Performance measure 3, we look at our initial response time to consumer complaints. We feel as though this is important because time is of the complaints that come in. As far as the completion time, we can look at that, but frankly, once I actually go out to somebody's place, if I find something, I have very little control over when that's going to end. I may walk in and maybe something I can handle in 5 minutes. It may be something like, say, we walked in, there's 1,300 violations, and so that's going to take a little bit of time because we're going to put a notice out, and then there's going to be hearings, and attorneys get involved in things. But that initial response time is important to the consumers of the state of Oregon, because where we may receive 100-plus complaints each year, that person probably only had one. And so their complaint is important to them, and it's important to us that we do an initial response right away. And that response could be a phone call to the person. It could be a visit to the person. And our least favorite, of course, is a letter. If we can't get a hold of somebody, we're going to get a letter out to them to have some kind of response come back.
Two comments. First of all, I would agree with my good friend and colleague, Representative Krupp, that your display perhaps could be a little bit more efficient. But why the considerable drop from your target in 2003 to 2004?
Well, we got a better investigator. I'm just teasing. I was the former investigator.
Yep.
What actually happened was when I first came onto the board, this may not have been as important. And so I was under a different leadership, and there was different goals for that investigator. When I was given the opportunity to be the interim director, I felt like this was a very important thing that we do here, that it's important that we do it, and we do it now. So I made it a high priority. And now that I actually have been able to hire somebody and have them on, I want to say from 11 of 03, they know that this is of utmost importance to me. So they work very hard to make sure that they meet this goal. So it's management. It's management to the performance measure. I think beforehand we weren't really managing towards the performance measure, and I feel it's important that we get out there and take care of that.
That's fine. That's a very acceptable answer.
Okay. And then the last performance measure is we're trying to look at the people that we directly affect each year. This is a very new and it's an evolving one, and I actually considered modifying it this year, but I was encouraged by the project board not to do that, to go ahead and give us some more time. But what we're trying to measure here is if I go out and I talk to somebody and that directly affects 100 of their clients, that's what I'm looking at, is those 100 people. We feel as though as an agency we have an indirect effect on Oregonians, lots of Oregonians, but a direct effect. They actually had a return done by this person that there may be a problem with. That's the number that I'm looking at here.
I'm going to pick up on something you said and probe a little bit here. Forgive me for asking a kind of sensitive question. Okay. It's clear to me that as the leader of this agency, you reflect many of the values that lots of us are looking for in an agency head. You're nimble. You take this very seriously. You have demonstrable improvements in your agency. As you got ready to prepare your performance measures, and particularly when you say that you're managing to your performance measures, how helpful did you find the Progress Board in providing you with measurement devices that allowed you to have the kind of success that you've had with this board?
Senator Johnson, I would say that they were very helpful to me. One of the things that the state is deficient on is training executive directors. We get trial by error. We get kind of thrown in there and asked to do these things. And every time I called them and asked them for help, they were available to me. And so I would have to applaud the Progress Board.
Thank you.
Okay, and then I'd like to talk about the prioritization. I had a very difficult time with the prioritization list. I feel that my agency is a three-legged stool, and you start pulling a leg out, and we fall over.
I'd like to call the committee's attention to the fact that we have a new prioritization at our places rather than the one that was provided in the book.
Do we need the old one? Is it a replacement or just a replacement?
It is a replacement. I apologize, but I guess I wasn't up to my mask. So I tried to get this I had problems with this exercise because being a small agency with four personnel, it's tough to take a program away, and you'll see that with the reduction plan. In the reduction plan, you take education, or you take compliance away, and then all of a sudden we become an agency that just issues a credential, and that's something that I don't want to see. But I prioritize these as licensing first. It's kind of chicken and egg. We've got to have a license before we can do anything. We looked at compliance and enforcement, and that includes education at the next level. Without a compliance program, certainly we could have a licensing program out there, but if somebody called to complain, or we had to look at continuing education to go forward, in a renewal without this program, basically the people of the state of Oregon get nothing for it. I mean, our licensees pay to get a credential, but they don't get any protection, so our mission goes out the window. The last program I put in here was administration, and I prioritized myself last. And these are the functions that I think are essential to the board. Without some kind of direction for any kind of agency, then I think all we do is spin ourselves in circles. And we may accomplish a thing here or there, but there's no vision and there's no direction. And that's where I feel that my part comes in. So that's how I prioritize them. The numbers are there for each program and the reduction plan.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Delce, do you have any comments from the staff perspective on this?
Yeah, I would.
Please.
It's personal observation, and I've had this agency now since I got here in 1998, and there has been a dramatic change. I believe the chair tried to point it out, is the situation that they came from 2 years ago with a deficit in their account, which just... That was only the symptom of the problems I thought that we saw here with the agency, and a great many changes have taken place, and I think it's all to the good, Madam Chair. So you know, we did have problems with this agency and its budget in the past. There were issues about there were a lot of operational issues where the agency was going, what the board was doing that have been addressed by the board and staff, and so I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you very much. Satish, I'd invite any comment from you if you wanted to offer one.
The manager and members of the committee, I agree with Alex. Yes, this agency did have problems. There were some cash flow problems in 2001, and that's now gotten out of it. And there's also some ending balance.
Great. Any questions from the committee?
Just a quick observation.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. When you look at the cash flow budget, it's still relatively tight, though, on the anticipated revenue versus anticipated expenses, and it wouldn't take much of a glitch to be dipping into that ending fund balance. But it sounds like you understand that issue, and it sounds like you're on top of it.
Can I make a comment?
Please.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I recognize that. In fact, I think when I met with the chair, she asked me what my biggest issue was, and I think this I said was my biggest issue. But I felt as though, as an agency, we owed it to our licensees to go one more biennium before we talk about a fee increase. At the end of this next biennium, it will be 6 years since the last time they had a fee increase, and so I wanted to go one more, and we do have a $216,000 balance. So if I'm off a little bit, we can get into that, but I don't predict that I'm going to be off. I've always been pretty conservative in my estimates, and I think that's one thing the board has appreciated over the time.
Bella?
What is the fee? And perhaps that was mentioned earlier. What does somebody
pay? It was, but we'll do it again.
I'm sorry. That's what I get for being late.
Actually, there's a set of fees, and I'm...
Well, you and I can discuss it later. I don't want to take the committee's time on that.
I've given some of them during the presentation, but some of the big ones are consultants pay a fee of $75 for their license. It's per year. Now, they also pay a fee of $95 for business registration, but if they renew timely, there is a renew on time with a combined registration, it's $120 for both.
Rather than you going through these fees, perhaps I could just summarize for Representative Smith and say the thing that has impressed me the most is the administrator's acknowledgement on the record that keeping fees low for his licensees was important, particularly people entering the profession and taking the threshold examination. His sensitivity to the need to raise fees has been clearly demonstrated throughout the testimony and his conversation with me prior to this hearing. And so, in my estimation, this is an administrator who is very sensitive to keeping fees low for the benefit of his licensees.
Thank you.
And Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this an annual license fee? All your fees are annual?
Senator Johnson, Senator Morse, yes, they are. We actually renew twice a year. The consultants renew in May, and the preparers renew in September.
Bella?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It might be that this is in a phase two discussion, but I would be interested to know the genesis for some of the legislation that seems to be targeting your agency and what might be behind that, some bills that are coming out of the House that you referenced that I took note to. It looked like, at first blush, looking at your commentary, is that someone must think that you're heavy-handed. Just the reading of your narrative. Now, I would be curious just to have some explanation as to why we have these bills on the docket.
Let's bring everybody's attention to page 10 in the opening narrative. And I think we would all appreciate having a comment on those.
Okay. Actually, in the last session, the State Bar had put together a legislative concept and had a bill out there that included all of these things in one bill, and that was to eliminate our ability to come back and charge folks for the cost of prosecuting them. To get rid of the agency's ability to assess cost. It also, there was a bill, in that same bill, it would give the authority to the administrative law judge for final authority as opposed to the board itself. So the board would not have any activity in the final decision on a contested case. This time they've actually split those two things up and are doing it in two separate bills. And the first one, from my understanding with discussions with the Department of Justice, is that we are unique in prosecuting folks in that we can recover our costs, but they can't recover their costs. So if, in other words, if that person won, they couldn't come back and recover their costs. And if we win, we can recover our costs. So the state bar's thinking on that is, you know, that's not fair. So that's why they want to put that in there. I don't think it's because us personally are heavy-handed. It's because they don't think that that is real-world type of situation. The other one on the administrative law judge, it's again, there's been a lot of migration of authority towards the hearings officer panel. And the reason I would be against this is because I think it's important for people in their industry to go before their boards that they that are appointed by the governor to explain their case. And the administrative law judge can set the record, and that's the record that we're going to talk about. So the board isn't able to add to that record. They can just talk about the record that's created in that initial hearing. But if you give them the last say, then the boards really aren't involved in it. So me, as if I was a licensed tax consultant, I wouldn't be able to come before my board and say, you know, I made a mistake, or maybe I didn't make a mistake. I wouldn't be able to have any explanation at all to them. It would all be to this quote-unquote impartial party that really doesn't understand our industry. So that's why I wouldn't be in favor of it. But again, the state bar feels as though this is a place where the decision should be made. And they tried for it the last biennium in a package, and it didn't go through. This biennium, they kind of split it up. And
so the legislation that has been introduced is specifically drafted at the request of the bar.
Right. It is not at us. And by the way, this agency, when we do assess people costs, all we assess is our attorney's time and the hearings officer time. We do not assess investigator time or anything else. We're already paying for those folks. We don't assess paperwork, copies, anything like this. It's simply the bill we get from the AG's office, from the Department of Justice. I'm sorry, he's an acronym again. And the bill we get from the Administrative Hearings Office.
Mr. Wayne.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ron. Wasn't that provided for in the statute not too long ago so that you could recover those costs? I thought that was since
Senator
my
Johnson.
Tenure.
Yes. Yes, Senator Johnson, Mr. Wayne, yes, it was provided in the 2001 legislative session.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Do you have a follow-up?
Just an observation. So, thank you, Madam Chair. Your conclusion is that it's more of a turf-related issue than it is directed at a deficiency within your agency.
I don't think it, I'm sorry, Senator Johnson, Senator Morse, I do not think it's a deficiency of our agency specifically. I think it's on the operations of basically how the hearings are going and agencies that have the ability to charge fees back, charge the assessment back. It's not just our agency.
Just so I understand this process, if you're dealing with a violation, you engage the Attorney General's office to assist you in that violation, and then the Attorney General cannot then in turn bill you for the time that they spend. Is that, am I on track or falling off?
Senator Johnson, Senator Morse, the process is that we conduct an investigation on a violation that we feel is a violation. Once the information is gathered, we will then recruit the help of our Assistant Attorney General, and we will provide them with the file, and we will put a notice out, and they will look at that notice and make sure that it is correctly written. At that time, the person has rights to appeal that decision, and then they'll go to a hearing, and the hearings officer will listen to that and make a proposed order, and then the board comes back and looks at that proposed order and makes a final order, at which time that person still has appeal rights to the Court of Appeals. Now, as far as the billing goes, we get billed per hour from the Attorney General's office. So whatever hours we use of our Assistant Attorney General, we are billed for that. So we pay those bills on a monthly basis. Now, if we win our case, then we would come back and we would say you used 20 hours of Attorney General at, I'm just going to, the math easy in my head, $100 an hour, so we're going to bill you $2,000, and that would be part of the assessed cost in the final order. So it'll say you got a civil penalty of, you know, $10,000, and you have a board cost of $2,000 for a total of $12,000 owed to us. But we've already paid, as an agency, we have paid the Department of Justice for that service.
And we'll have a chance to learn more about this issue if those bills get legs under them, I guess. But thank you.
The last bill that was here is the signing for affirmation, and we agreed to go along with that, and I think this is a bill that the regulatory streamlining put forward to try to make it in the future that we can have online applications without having to have a signature. So we didn't want to be in the way of that. And currently people sign our forms under penalty of perjury.
So the one bill that you're really watching is House Bill 2284, and on 2095, you're less concerned about that one.
2095, I'm in favor of that one.
Okay.
I support that one.
Any other issues on this point that we want to discuss? Any other questions for the panel? I think we would just conclude by saying this has been a very enjoyable presentation, both to see such an engaged agency administrator and also, Madam Chair of the Board, it's clear that with your encouragement and a supportive and engaged board, your agency has been able to go forward. It is my observation that absent that board engagement and board oversight, an administrator cannot succeed. And it's clear just in watching this presentation that you've got a great relationship between your volunteer citizen board and your professional administrators. So on behalf of the committee, thank you for your willingness to step forward and help this agency. It's delightful to see such a nimble entrepreneurial agency. This has been a very pleasant hearing. Thank you for coming so well prepared. And unless there is objection or question from the committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5528 and declare us adjourned without exception.